listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood, this is your host with the most, Nikki Kolula, for another quarantine edition of Wake Up Hollywood. We have a special guest in the studio today, Mr. Damien Poitier. Say hello, Damien.
Hello, everybody.
I know I butchered your last name. Say it for me so I know how it should sound.
There's actually a few different pronunciations. The English pronunciation is Poitier. The true French pronunciation is Poitier.
Poitier, that's right.
I've also heard Poitier. Right? Yeah.
Man. And what's the heritage?
It's Bahamian by way of Haiti.
Wow.
I didn't know there was I didn't know about the Haitian connection until I talked to one of the elders.
So I have to ask you, do you know any Creole recipes? I'm sure you have some Creole. You got some. Creole
it's more Haitian West Indian. It's not really.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not really the Creole. Yeah, Poitiers got it's the French sound, but like I said, it's French through Haiti, not through New Orleans.
So it's not, no, but I mean, a lot of that, some of that is influenced by that, because that's how a lot of New Orleans got its influence.
Right.
I just assume that would be running through some of those recipes, man. But, you know, I'm a big foodie, so that's why I asked, man.
Right. Oh, okay. Yeah, so, no, I grew up in Philadelphia, so we did, you know, Northeast food, you know, but I was in Pennsylvania, so we did Scrapple. Lots of Scrapple.
Well, I have to ask you, where's your favorite cheesesteak in Philly, man? Do you have a spot?
It was, wow, I'm blanking on the name. I think it was a Mel's, actually. There's a Mel's cheesesteak. Okay. Yeah, it's one of the ones from the hood. It's not, not on the
that's the stuff I like to know, man. I've been to Geno's and what are the two big ones? There's Geno's and something else, but Jim's is one of my favorites. Jim's is good. Right.
But I do my cheesesteak different. I do mine with ketchup, mayonnaise, and then
awesome.
Cheesesteak. Yeah, and then I do onions in, you know, onions mixed in.
Yep.
And then I do, so then that's how I do mine.
That's like a burger. I love it, dude.
Yeah, ketchup, mayonnaise on the bread, you know, then the cheese, then the onions with the steak. That's
crazy.
I've been doing that way, since I could remember. My mom said when she was pregnant with me, like, nobody could even walk in the house without a cheesesteak. She was eating cheesesteaks all day, every day. So.
Dude, your mom and I would be pals because that's one of my favorite grandma, man. So you and I met at a wedding, and we met at Lamont's wedding, who's also been a guest. So I wanted to ask, have you and Lamont ever worked together?
Yeah, we're actually working on things together. Awesome. You know, we got stuff we're pitching because – you know, along with the performance, I do a little writing, and along with the writing, he does some producing. So we're putting things together. You'll be seeing stuff out of us soon.
That's awesome. I figured. I never asked then, but you know, I remember I was sitting in the. And you didn't say anything to anybody about this, but I think it was the first Avengers movie, right?
What
was
that? Yeah.
And I'm sitting in the theater, and then all of a sudden, I see you in this big scene in the beginning, and I'm like, "Oh, dude, I've got to ask him if that's was definitely him."
Yeah. At the end. Yep.
So tell me what that whole situation was like to film that, and also just like that's a huge movie, and you have to kind of like be tight-lipped about it. So tell me what that whole experience was like.
Well, it was crazy because you know I didn't even realize who I was playing until I was in the makeup chair.
Wow.
They didn't tell me. Like I was walking in, because I was walking in the makeup studio to do the face cast because it was all makeup. They did some CGI additives to it, but the original appearance was makeup it's come out. You know, there's pictures of it all over the place. But I walked in and, you know, I sat down in the chair. I was walking in. I was, you know, you always look around when you're in a makeup shop because there's always lots of cool stuff. And he had Spider-Man. He had Wolverine's X2 costume.
Dude.
He had, you know, there's a Dr. Doom maquette in there. There was, like, the creatures from Battle Los Angeles. Like, there was all so much cool stuff in there. He had the helmets from Black Eyed Peas. He did one of their shows. Yeah, it was, like, there was some Tron stuff. I was just, like, I was just, like.
Right.
And I saw a drawing. I saw a mock-up of Thanos. And I was like, oh, shit, Thanos is going to be in the movie. That's so dope.
That's crazy. You kind of got a glimpse before anybody else really saw the movie or anything of who was going to be introduced in the movie.
Yeah, I found out in the makeup chair. Literally, I was in the makeup chair, and I was sitting there because I thought I was playing a Skrull.
Wow.
I was like, okay, I was like big non-speaking end of Avengers, probably gonna be the Skrulls, you know, they're not gonna go too big. So I'm sitting there and I was like, so I saw the Thanos, and they were like, yeah. And I was like, that's cool. And
like, now, when you're in that situation, yeah. That's like, you're like a kid in a candy shop, essentially. Because that is like comic book heaven. Like, all of a sudden, you see the characters. Are you just like, what's that? Who's in that? Who's doing that?
No, well, I recognized most of it. So I was pretty cool because I knew what it was. But I was just like, inside, I was like, but like, I was I was sitting in a chair. And I was like, oh, cool. You guys are going to have Thanos in the movie. And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, cool. He's like, you know that's you, right? And I'm like, I'm sorry, what?
Like, say that again, like, one more time. Yeah,
like, he's like, you're playing Thanos. And I was like,
that's wild.
Oh. Like,
this is like big shoes to fill. Now, you said you were into comic books. Like, when did you kind of like read about that character? Were you like a little kid, or were you kind of like did you?
Yeah, I read Infinity Gauntlet when it came out.
Right. Right.
So you know, I've been reading comics since I was really, really small. You know what I mean? So, yeah, my dad had me reading comics before. You know, I was looking at pictures of comics before I could even read them. Like, I've comics since.
So that was kind of like your first movie. I mean, the comic books were like your first cinematic experience in some ways, right?
It was one of my first big movie. Yeah.
That's crazy. So tell me about like when you were starting to act, or when did you kind of know? What was the moment of zen that you knew this is what you wanted to do?
Dude, I was 4.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, and I was watching something on TV, and I saw Sidney Poitier, and he looked a lot like my grandfather. And he was doing the whole thing, and I said, I looked at my mom and said, who's that? And she said, that's your cousin. And I said, what's he doing? She said, he's acting. I said, I want to do that. And it was over. It was a wrap from there.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And then as I got older, I realized that I could do everything as an actor. You know, right. I played Street Thug, Intergalactic Conqueror.
Right. Right. Well, it's also like, you know, it's like the imagination is expanded, but like there's a centralized core to each character. How do you kind of apply like how to wear the hat for each kind of character? Like, what do you do? Method acting? Do you kind of do like, you know, Uta Hagen's respect for acting? Like, what's your process?
It depends on the role, honestly. You know, because the thing is, like, obviously you want to have an inner life and things like that, but the other issue is, especially, you know, because I come from a stunt side of things, you don't want to overpower your actor in the scene,
right?
You know, you want to be matched to or lesser in terms of how you're coming off to your actor. So depending on what it is I'm doing, I'll do the amount of work required to make sure I'm leveling up. And that also helps to know who you're acting against and to know what their performance level is.
Right.
You know, so you can kind of figure out, okay, where do I want to be? You know, so it really depends on the role.
And now you said you came from the stunt side of things. How did you get involved with that? Yeah, tell me about that.
Dude, once I hit high school, I was like, you know what? I should be doing martial arts if I want to do action movies. Because, you know,
people
who do martial arts, being able to fight is a key part of being in an action movie. And I watched, you know, Saturday Morning Kung Fu and all that stuff. So I was like, I want to learn martial arts. I started learning martial arts. And then through that.
How old were you when you started?
It was later. I was like 18, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So then I went, but I did a full dive. Like, I didn't go to college. I was in the dojo.
Wow. That's amazing.
So for 3 years of just nothing, but, you know, I started cross training in gymnastics so I could do some flips on screen as well. Like, I went deep dive, and it was just started teaching. And then we decided to move to Florida, and we ended up being a part of the demo team for the martial arts.
Wow.
For the school. And so we were doing fight scenes with my martial arts instructor, and I really started. I used to do fight scenes before I could do martial arts. So once I actually knew martial arts, you know, I really started tightening up fight scenes. So we moved to Orlando, and when I first got to Orlando, we were just looking around for something to do to see how we could get involved in entertainment. And we found there was a low budget martial arts movie audition.
What?
And I was like, yeah, it was just a low budget. There was just an open call. I don't even know how we heard about it, but somehow we heard about a low budget martial arts movie audition. So we went. And a couple of the guys who were there had been in the movie Blade.
Wow.
So they were like, yo, you know, they saw me. I did what's called a barrel roll, which is basically, you know, that big twisty movement.
Right.
When you get kicked with a spin kick. Right. And I did that to the ground at 6'4", and they were like, all right, keep an eye on that dude. And they grabbed my information. Like, get his information. Because somebody that big throwing that kind of move.
Right.
You know, just, yeah. So they kept my information, and with the, there was a whole group of them. And, you know, some of them have become really good friends of mine, and some of them I talk to every once in a while, but they're all, you know, I still talk to all of them. And when the show Sheena, Queen of the Jungle came to Florida, it was, they had like 5 black stuntmen.
Wow.
And it was a legendary stunt coordinator, one of the founders of Stunts Unlimited. His name's Glenn Wilder. He recently passed a few years back, but Glenn Wilder was coordinating the show. So he, the stunt group that I was chilling with, they had actually gotten in contact with him. And he said, you know, bring whoever you guys got that are good guys that can move in, you know, and I'll see if there's anybody I can use, or we'll just talk about stunts and we'll learn more about stunts. So we went to his house. He had us over to his house. We're all hanging out and talking and everything like that. And he goes, oh, you do any fighting? And I was like, well, I've been, you know, training martial arts, this and that, that and that. And he goes, oh, okay. Let me throw a couple punches at you. See what you got. So he throws some punches at me. Yeah, well, just throw some punches for me to react to.
Okay.
Not hit me.
I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah. So he throws some punches, and I threw some reactions, and he goes, you want to be a stuntman?
That's wild. Dude, that, you and know I what? Said, I have to say, like, a stuntman is, like, on every little kid's, like, list of things they want to do. When you see that, you're like, that's what I want to do. But then it's like, oh, my God, I can't do that.
I didn't even know, like, I didn't really have a concept of what that was.
Right.
You know, before, you know, like, really becoming focused on entertainment. So it was like a cool idea, but I was like, but then I realized there's guys you saw in the background of every single TV show that got in a fight.
Right. Well, I always think it's always a big thing with the Oscars. It's like, mm-hmm. How is that, like, not an
honor? I've heard so many tales. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous that. But part of the problem with it being an Oscar, or at least from my little bit of thinking, is that it peels back the mystery.
Right. Yeah, but so does the writing on some level.
Of course. But no, it's no longer a valid thing. But I could see how in the past, with actors not really wanting to, you know, be like, oh, I don't do my own stunts. Like now, like right. even now, I don't do all my own stunts when I act.
Right. So, really? You're like, no, I don't do that. Let's bring in the stunt guy.
Well, they'll have somebody do it for me. But I'm still capable of it. I still sometimes every once in a while do a stunt gig. But yeah, I don't do everything.
I have to ask you: right. Was there ever a stunt that you were like, oh, I don't know if I should do that? There had to have been something that you were like,
oh, of course. I've refused. I just refuse. If I can't do it, I won't do it.
What's a stunt that you were like, I'm not doing that?
There was a couple of driving things that they asked me to do, and I'm not, you know, I didn't put the time in the drive. I'm like, no, you know, and, you know, I think one time I got asked to do some high fall work, and I hadn't worked on my high falls in a while, and I was like, but yeah, I one of the reasons that I worked so steadily is because the coordinator knew that I would absolutely be honest about my abilities,
right.
You know, like, because, you know, it's time and money.
Yeah, no, not only that, it's like, there are stuntmen and women that have died on the gig. So it's like, you're literally like signing up for something that you're
Sometimes it's not even a lack of ability. Sometimes that's why there are stuntmen, because it's dangerous.
Right.
I've done numerous stunts that could have ended incredibly poorly. But through the fact that, you know, I had a good team, you know, I trusted myself. I trusted my work. They trusted me. I trusted them. Through all that, everything worked out fine.
But how do you practice that? Like, that's what's crazy.
Well, it's just like everything else. You practice the basics, and then you do heightened basics.
Right.
You know, so you practice. So, okay, I'm going to fall 50 feet. Okay, so I'll stand on my desk and drop to a mat. Then I'll stand on something higher and drop to the mat. And I'll start to get a feeling of where my body is in the air and what I need to do to land. And then there's practice high fall things. There's towers like 50 to 60 foot towers so you can practice your high falls off of.
That is crazy.
You know, there's fire stunts. There's all kinds of different, you know, stunts that happen. And you just have to find out who's doing it, you know, find out who works on it, find out what goes into doing it. But it's the art of making something that's very controlled look incredibly uncontrolled.
Yeah, and you know what I love about it too?
It's just really physical acting. Yeah, it's very physical acting.
I agree. And you know what? Like, I'm old school. So, like, I used to go to Universal Studios as a kid, and they used to have a Wild West stunt show.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
With real stuntmen, and they would show you exactly what happened. And they make kind of, like, fun of, like, what it is, but they'd show you what the stunt is, and then they would make it look like it's a real stunt that's happening. But, yep. like, either way, it's still a risk on either side. And
a lot of those guys work in the film and television industry, and a lot of those guys got their start from Universal to go into the film and television industry.
And I miss that. Yeah. They don't do that as much now because it's probably a liability or it's too crazy. So let me ask you this. So done, yeah. From stuntman to actor, that's not an easy transition. Tell me what it was like for you to get to that level.
Well, it's kind of still ongoing because until I've done a series regular, you know what I mean, or played like, you know, in the top five of a movie or a show, I don't know that I can, you know what I mean, say I firmly made that
switch. But yeah, I don't believe that because it's like you're already doing stuff.
The stunt costs still come in, and I'm still going.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to do that. This is what I want to do. But I mean, I also feel like, you know, they're like watermarks in every career. It's like you want to always challenge yourself. So like, even if you're doing a series regular and you're into a character, it'll be something else. It'll be some other character.
But once I'm doing series regular work, I'm going to be a lot less likely to go back to stunts. Now, not to say I don't know guys who have done series regulars who are going back to stunts. I said a lot less likely. I didn't say I wasn't going to do it. I just said I'm feeling like, you know, once I've hit that, and I'm doing a lot more motion capture, voiceover, you know, and the my performance aspect has moved away from stunts to some degree. And, you
what
know,
a, it's not what a cool more. World you live in. I mean, dude, motion capture, that's awesome, dude. Tell me a little bit about that. Like, how did you get involved with that, and what made it exciting or challenging for you?
I actually got involved in motion capture because my arm length is the same arm length as Snoop Dogg's, and they were doing a Snoop Dogg video game.
That's
cool. It never got released. It got scrapped. But because I had the wingspan, because back then when they first started doing it, they didn't have as precise, you know, they weren't able to scale as easily.
Right.
And model and stuff. So it was a lot more, there was a lot more involved in trying to match things to make things easier for the animators. Now it's some, with the computers being the way they are, it's so much scaling, things like that. But I went down to San Diego for 2 weeks. Every day, I put on the balls, got in the volume, and we just worked through it. And I just went through all the characters. And since I did that, and that was early on in the mocap game. It was very early on the mocap game. But since I did that, my name's just kind of always been bandied about. And like a couple times a year, somebody be like, "Hey man, come do this mocap thing."
That's awesome.
Yeah, and it's like,
Do you ever feel like when they actually, you know, take the footage and or the measurements or whatever they're doing, the data, and then they apply it, do you feel like it's like, oh yeah, that is as accurate as it can be, or do you feel like there's still a little bit of a gap because you're seeing it in a way that we don't ever see it? You know what I mean?
Well, there's a, I think the gap is in the palette of the animation, not in the movement.
Huh.
So in other words, it's the frame that they're putting it on.
Right.
You know, I mean, don't get me wrong. Now we got Avatar and things like that where, you know, you can barely tell the difference between reality and CGI. Right. But there's still a slight – the Uncanny Valley hasn't quite been conquered yet.
Right.
And they're working hard on that. But, you know, now you got things like deepfake, you know, which is essentially CGI face replacement, you know, and things like that. So there's a lot of things you can do now that you can kind of where it's getting closer and closer. Like, did you see the Mandalorian deepfake?
Are you
caught up?
Yeah. No, I'm only on the first season. So no spoilers, man.
No, I didn't. That's why I just said Mandalorian deepfake. I didn't say anything else.
Yep, leave alone. No, everybody's been telling me about it. They're like, dude, because I'm a huge Star Wars freak. And
oh, man.
I knew I wasn't going to. That's the thing. It's like, I knew I wasn't going to, like, watch one at a time because they were at first just doing one at a time. So I was I'm going to binge this probably in an afternoon. So I'm kind of like waiting to give myself that time to just kind of like binge the whole thing.
Get through it. Okay.
Actually, one of my guests was one of the makeup artists on Mandalorian. Oh, nice. And he talked about the whole process of like what it was like. And they had to like, you know, they knew characters they were building, but they couldn't know that much about the entire world because
I love prosthetics, dude. Prosthetics is so much fun.
Well, dude, I've got, like, the funny thing about doing this show, it's like I'm assembling all these people and connections with artists and makeup artists and, you know, camera people and directors and writers. And it's like, man, just with the people that have been on this show, it's like, dude, we could put together a film. And it's kind of interesting just to see how that all is
connected. Different aspects.
Yeah. But I mean, like for you doing the stuntman thing and then doing motion capture and then doing voiceover, that's a totally different transition.
Dude, the stunts and voiceover are polar opposites.
Yeah, tell me how. Tell me how and why.
Well, because with stunts, usually there's you're not speaking. So there's no vocalization. It's all communication through body.
Right.
Right. Same thing with motion capture if there's no vocal aspect to it. You're communicating all the ideals through your body, your emotions, your whatever it is, you know, your threat level. You know, like I said, you're matching your level of the actor, or if you need to be like something like a horror creature, then you're making sure that you're bigger in your presence and what you're doing and your movements and everything like that. So everything is based off of how you move and what you do with your energy and your, you know, and your projection. With voice, everything comes from here. It's complete. You don't have any kind of visual, physical reference to do it. Now, you'll move around when you're doing voiceover work, but everything has to be communicated through a tone.
Right.
You know, like I could. I
have to go through a coach or anything like that, like to kind of like learn some of that.
I used to sing.
Oh, okay.
So I have pretty good vocal control still from when I used to sing and things like that. And I've always done voices. So that's always been helpful. That's awesome. Right after Beauty and the Beast came out, I realized that I could do the Beast voice.
What?
And I started doing it all over the place. Yeah. So, and then, you know, you can do different things with that. And do different things with that. They give you different vocal ranges and things. Yeah.
That's wild,
so,
dude.
Yeah, so I started playing around with that.
You kind of, like, calls to do, like, villains, like, you know, like, evil creatures.
The range, man. I've done, you know, I spent months doing background orcs for the World of Warcraft movie.
That's amazing, dude.
Just months doing that. You know, I did Sloth and Wrath on Shazam. I helped out on those voices and just, you know, and then I've done just, you know, I actually did just a Luke group for Luke Cage. I was one of the background voices for the TV show Luke Cage.
That's crazy.
You know?
So you're still in that special effects world and all the comic book fantasy stuff. You're like living in that. Do you feel like there are still things you want to conquer within that realm? Is it more on screen? Is it more writing and directing? Is it kind of a combination?
Well, one of the things I've noticed, like, and it's much less prevalent than when I started in this business, though, was there weren't a whole lot of characters that looked like me in the genres that I enjoy.
Right.
You know, still aren't a lot of blacks in fantasy, and you can see there's a lot of fantasy books on my shelf.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Those are all D&D books. Fantasy books.
Yeah.
You know, but fantasy's always been like a deep love of mine, and there's very few black fantasy characters.
Well, it's going to change.
But that requires, you know, like you said, am I going to write? Yeah, I'm going to have to.
Right.
Because I'm not seeing.
I was so stoked to see you watch. I'm sure you saw Soul. Did you see Soul yet?
I've seen some of it. I haven't watched the whole thing.
Oh, man, it's so good. And it's like.
There's been a lot of discussion about that. But they're doing the whole, you know, take the black character and then make him something else so he's not actually in the movie thing.
Well, you know what I like about it? Black
face doing the fantasy.
They actually did some cool things because they actually showed a lot more of African-American characters portraying African-American characters than an African-American character portrayed in some white presence world that is
But even so, I mean, the whole thing with 22.
Right.
That was a white voice.
Right.
You know, in a white journey in a black space.
Well, I mean, there's so many things that are like, it baffles me how what you said is exactly the truth. It's like, why isn't there more of this? Why Black Panther took forever to become a thing, and then it was so successful when it was.
And they haven't done anything.
Yeah.
They haven't done they did not at all take advantage of what Black Panther provided. Black Panther provided a clear path to continued black genre excellence on screen, and they did not follow up.
Well, you know what's weird? It's like you're touching on something really awesome. I love that. I just got chills talking about it because, you know, I think about this all the time, and it's something that I think it's going to take a long time to change. But also, it's like it takes the game changers to write the parts like yourself, to think about the characters, to you know, put everything in your hands to make the movie that you want to make. Because, man, that's the only way it's going to happen. You know, when you, yeah, when you make something great and it becomes what it is, that's set the trend.
What needs to be done is the community needs to be built.
Right.
You know, you need the machine. You don't just need the people, because individuals will make Black Panther.
Right.
You know what I mean? We don't have the Star Wars machine or the game. There's certain things that have a machine around them or a infrastructure about them. We don't have a Black genre infrastructure yet.
Right. But you know what? What's amazing is, you know, Chadwick. He obviously, he passed away. But right. I watched Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I don't know if you've seen
it. I haven't seen it yet. I need to watch it. Dude, I need to watch that.
So slamming, and yeah, he literally gives a masterclass on how to act in that whole movie, beginning to end. He's going to get the Oscar because, and I literally said that out loud. I was like, he's definitely going to get a nomination, and he's definitely going to win, because there's nobody that's going to be able to compete with that kind of performance. And the sad thing is, he was in a lot of pain going through that whole performance, but he laid it on the line. And it's like, you know, when you see an ensemble like that portraying a story like that about something like that, and you see a performance like that, it's like, why isn't this always a thing? And that's something that I just ask Hollywood.
Like I said, we don't have the infrastructure. There's no every time the infrastructure has been built, it's been dissolved. It has been dissolved into the greater, like you know, Blaxploitation saved Hollywood.
Right, right. Do you think people like Tyler Perry are in a more powerful position to do that, or do you think they get pigeonholed because they have to make that comedy that is kind of like self-effacing or something like that?
It's difficult, as I know personally from my transition from actor to stuntman, once you get known for a thing, to step out of that thing and do something else.
Right.
Basically, what you have to do is throw a big risk at an unknown quantity. You know, you're eating over here. You're eating good over here. You have to do this here and hope to God that it breaks out.
Right.
Because if it doesn't, that could actually interrupt your eating. Because they're like, oh, well, you're trying to do this now. So there's a whole thing with that of where it's tricky and difficult to step out. And once you start getting into once you become a part of the system, it's more difficult to disrupt it.
Right. I can understand that. I've got a great question that I'm dying to ask you. Because all those fantasy books that you are into, you did not see people of color in these stories, right?
For the most part, very few. Really. Not as many as I would like.
And they're not like major prominent. Like, but I love that you're still such a huge fan of the stories. How do you feel, like, what was the disconnect, or how did you put that away? Or did you, and you just wanted to enjoy it and now bring it to life as you're working on projects now?
Well, it's I've been reading these books all my life. You know, it's like, for example, when they talk about casting a Black Superman, I don't want to see a Black Superman.
Right.
I wouldn't mind seeing a Val Zod.
Right.
But he's not Superman. He's a different character.
Right.
You can do a different Kryptonian, that's fine. But the characters that came up the way they are, and that's one of the difficulties in pushing, you know, characters in, because superheroes are like a pantheon.
Right.
You know, so you have these different gods and these different psychopomps, and to push a new psychopomp in is tricky.
Right.
You know, there has to be some kind of societal shift that enables a space for that superhero to rise. That's how Wolverine came into play. That's how Punisher came into play. That's how Deadpool's come into play. There was a space for those characters and a time when those characters kind of started resonating and they're able to gain purchase. And it's difficult to push a new character, and then you push new characters unfamiliar, because we live in a patriarchal Judeo-Christian,
right,
you know, heterosexual world.
But
we're becoming aware
of
that and expanding on it. But
the one thing that never changes is a good story. You know what I mean? It's like,
true. but if you, but if you don't have access to it,
right? What if you write it? That's what I'm saying. It's like mm-hmm. all of these stories, the you know, all those books behind you are there because they have some story to offer. And it's like right. the crazy thing that I this is these are things that I ponder just in my own world. It's like, you know, the music world is very similar to the film world. You know, it's like it's easier for people to process white kid with a guitar or white girl with a piano or with a guitar than it is to see anybody else of color or, you know, with instruments singing in that kind of in that realm. Unless it's pigeonholed into one thing, like, oh, we expect this of your color or your people, whatever. You know what right. I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So okay. it's the same, but what definitely transcends is the content. It's like if the content is good, then it gets the eyeballs, it gets the ears. So do you feel like there is not a vehicle for the content, or do you feel like the content is disregarded because of old kind of like traditions, values, stereotypes?
It's a combination. We have a societal issue,
right?
Of like I said, we're a patriarchal, Euro Judeo Christian, hetero. That's the normative culture. So now, as long as that's normal, anything that's not on the normal line is automatically going to be met with some resistance because right. you're pushing against type. For what we've been taught is what is supposed to be normal, okay, and good. So you have to fight against type. When you have to fight against type, it requires a strength and a support, whether it's personal or whether it's people around you, a support, you know, infrastructure that we haven't built yet.
Right.
You know what but I mean?
You're, so, you're the, so the problem. You're building it, though. You're, I mean, like.
Yeah, oh, yeah. It's
like
coming.
And Lamont and, you know, creators mm-hmm. that are like, you know, seeing that it can be, it's not like one dimensional. Like, dude, you're not a one dimensional creator. That's why I wanted you on the right. show, because you have all these different facets. And it's well, like.
The tricky part, though, is you have to create, but at the same time as you're creating, you also have to work.
Right.
Because you have to stay relevant enough that when your creation comes out, people are even interested in watching.
Right. That's crazy, isn't
you know,
it?
So if you're part of the norm and you create and you put it out, there's automatically an audience and even regardless of whether or not you've been in the limelight, because you're a part of the norm, it's an easier push.
Right.
It's but becoming more difficult. There's so much stuff going on.
You got Sidney Poitier's blood running through your skin.
I'm incredibly fortunate, man. I'm well aware of how incredibly fortunate. I mean, my phone rings and there's people saying, "Hey, let me give you money to do this thing you love." I can't.
Right.
I cannot quantify that. I can't. That's you know the that's and it's a part of the. It's part of what my family, my parents, and those around me have cultivated in me to put me in a position to be able to be the person that you think to call when you got right. cash in your pocket and you need something done.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's an incredibly long list of you know people that helped me get there. That's my infrastructure. I have an incredibly sound infrastructure. So that's I right. want that for everybody. But I want right. that for everybody.
Right.
I want to build an infrastructure where anybody who's got an idea of talent or inspiration or whatever, you know, can find an outlet for it, can have people who are looking, call them and say, "Hey, let me give you money to do this thing." You know, yeah. that's what I want. I want things to shift so that everybody with ability has opportunity.
So we talked about like an influence. You said Sidney Poitier mm-hmm. was an influence when you were a kid. What about yeah. current influences, actors, directors, storytellers? Who are the people that are influencing you now as a creator?
Ooh, it's funny. Pulp is one of my favorite. I like superheroes. I like fantasy, and I like pulp. And pulp is one of my favorites. And there's these kind of pulpy. Like I've always read. Like I love schlock novels. Like I just love schlocky novels. And there's this genre called lit RPG. And it's basically the idea of it is there was It's kind of like the Dungeons & Dragons TV show. You know, they got stuck in the ride, but if you get stuck in a game.
Wow.
So the whole idea is you either get stuck in a game or you're able to, you're in virtual reality playing a game or something like that, where there's some aspect of you're going from one reality to another. And it's called I'm way mispronouncing that, and I apologize to my Japanese speakers. Right. But there's a whole genre of it in anime and manga of going from one world to another and either having two lives or going from one life to the next. And that's, you know, that's always been, you know, it's the old, the wizard calls, you go through the portal, you know, it's the old school, right. Like.
Yeah, that's Hero's Journey right there.
Oh, yeah, the classic Hero's Journey. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, Luke was a farmer, you know, he's a moisture farmer, and all of a sudden he's flying through space.
What's crazy is, like, that movie resonated with me so much. But, like, you know, a lot of the samurai stuff is what influenced George Lucas to do that.
Oh, absolutely.
Did any of the samurai stuff kind of infiltrate into your martial arts? Or, like, did you get into any of the sword stuff as well with martial arts?
I practice a lot of different disciplines. I've familiarized myself with enough to, if somebody says, hey, we need you to do this, 6 to 8 weeks, I can show up and be expert on it. You know what I mean? Like, if you put me through that that Spartacus boot camp that they had for anything, and I'm comfortable enough with most things that I could be on screen ready to knock it out, you know, with a little boot camp. Some things I wouldn't even need the boot camp for, but some, you know, other things with just that much space, because I just spend enough time, I have enough interest and just natural affinity to those things from reading them from the time I was a child, to, you know, to understand a bit about how the mechanics of it, how it works, in order to be able to portray it.
The irony, so, I'm sure, is in situations where you're auditioning for some of these characters, I'm sure you know a lot more backstory than a lot of the people that are working in these movies or directing them.
You know, it's funny, on some levels, I'm actually not as upset that I haven't penetrated as far into the superhero world, because there are roles that I wanted that when I saw how they did them, I was like, that's not that character. And it would have been upsetting for me, or it would have been disjointing for me to try to play like just a brass tack at Thanos.
Wow.
The movie Thanos wasn't Thanos. Thanos worshipped death and was brought back to life to destroy half the universe.
And they made him kind of like likable and on some level.
They tried to make him more of a sympathetic villain, right, in terms of he's trying to do a good thing. The problem is he's supposed to be a genius, and if you're a genius, you realize that if you destroy half the life of the universe, there's a principle, and I keep forgetting, I gotta start remembering this because I bring this up all the time, that if the pathways are set, it's actually the same principle as the European expansion of the U.S. There were 100 million Native Americans before European illnesses wiped them out, and it was like 10 million. And the reason why the Europeans were able to go across America so fast is not because, you know, they were amazing explorers, because the Native Americans had been building roads and ways and pathways, and they had already terraformed America for cross-country travel.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. That's So it's so, but that's the same kind of thing of if you have the resources readily available for expansion, then people will expand into it more quickly. Right. So if it took 80 years to get there, you snap and wipe out half the universe. In 40 years, it's going to, you know, 30, 40 years, it's going to be back where it was.
Right, right.
And the gauntlet broke. So it's not like he could come back and snap again. So it's like, so when you go over to there and you see that you need a external or you need more of an external influence to reconcile why he's doing that. It's internally inconsistent.
Right,
and I found that just found that jarring.
Well, especially because you're like so immersed in the world,
right?
You know what I mean, yeah. So like, you know the source material. You're right. Like, I know it in and out, and it's like, but I don't know who makes the call on that. If it's like there's
several. I've literally sat there and watched, you know, 7 to 8 high level Marvel execs go line by line over a story to find the tone of it. They're very specific in what they're looking for and in how they come to it. So there were viable. I mean, it worked. It didn't not work unless you really start to get into it. But it's a story. A story is about the journey and the emotion. It's not necessarily about the minutiae.
Right.
You know, so they told an effective story. Even if when you get into the minutiae of it, it starts to kind of unravel a bit.
Yeah, but you must have been like, wait a minute, that's not correct.
Well, yes and no. You know what I mean? I recognize, you know, there's characters, the way they brought in Captain America is not comic accurate. There, you know, these characters that come in, you know, Ant-Man was one of the founding Avengers, and he's not even there. So there's characters, there's some massaging that they did with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but they made it work. Right. Very little things in more things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe work than don't work.
Right. I'd agree with that.
And because they did some
of the foundations there.
Well, not only do they have the foundations, but they have the desire to portray the characters. Right. You know, they want you to see, even if it's not the Captain America you read about, you're looking at Captain America.
Right.
You know what I mean? The characters are true to themselves, even if there's some, you know, fiddling around with how to get
there. What I get irritated with you know, with entertainment in general, it's like, right, dude, give me the real. Give me the true story. Give me the core, because that's more sellable than taking that soft right. It's always going to be better.
Sometimes it doesn't translate.
Yeah, but like, give me an example. Like, watch Well, you mean the series or the movie?
The movie.
Yeah, the movie was bad.
It worked and it didn't work. It was it was a little too faithful in some ways, and then the deviations, you know what I mean? So it's like it worked, but there was something that was, you know, here's a good example. I've been reading fantasy my whole life, right? And when I think about fantasy, I think about paintings, because all the fantasy book covers are paintings.
Right.
So when I watch a fantasy movie, because it's not animated, because it's not painted, there's a disconnect for me.
Huh.
I never fully feel immersed in a fantasy movie. That's because it doesn't look like a painting.
Right. Or a comic.
You know what I mean? Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's that's a really weird, like when I'm watching, like when I watch Harry Potter and things like that, there's moments in there where I come out of it.
Right.
And there's a CGI moment or something that just doesn't mesh, and my eye's looking for the painting and it doesn't see it, it backs out.
Well, have you ever done any VR mazes or anything like that?
No, I need to do those. But so I've done some.
That is your VR world. Game. That is your, like, mm-hmm. I'm waiting for a VR movie experience, mm-hmm. because, like, you know, I was working on this animated project, and my director / animator or head of special effects, he was like, "Yo, you got to check this out." He's like, "This is VR. It's going to be big in 5 years." And he showed me the cardboard box before anybody even talked about VR. Now VR is everywhere. But like since then, to see like. Steven Spielberg opened a VR maze. It's called Dreamscape in Century City. And obviously right now it's closed, but it is like an animated, like you're walking in an animated world. It is like no experience you've ever had. And I'm waiting for movies to get to that level, because it's going to be a huge game changer when you can immerse yourself in a fantasy world where you're in the world and you look at your hands and they are the character's hands. It's not like a CG, you know, like fake thing. You know what I mean? You know, you've seen behind all the smoke and mirrors, like you're using your imagination to get that character across when you're doing a stunt or when you're doing motion capture. But like when you're in VR and you actually see the exact experience that you're supposed to have, it's going to change acting. It's going to change the experience for the audience. It's going to change storytelling a little bit. How do you feel like, you know, fantasy is kind of changing, you know, the motion picture or the film experience? Because like right now, so many of the movies that we're selling have been fantasy or special effects movies or comic book movies that have, you know, kind of like a built-in audience already. But do you think now with the pandemic, do you think that's going to change? Do you think it's going to be less geared towards that? It's going to be like a new resurgence or renaissance?
I think it's going to come back harder than ever.
You think because people are just dying to see that experience again, right?
People want to get out of reality, man.
Right. Right. For a lot of reasons. So, yeah.
Well, you know, you go to movies for an escape.
Right.
So when we start becoming and we're only becoming more and more capable of presenting you with a lifelike fantasy world.
Right. Right.
You know? And I think the next push is gonna be what we want is when you have multi ethnic in terms of humans fantasy worlds, as opposed to just, you know, things like that. So you're going to start seeing fantasy worlds that more resemble our world in terms of the makeup of people.
Right.
And that's going to bring more people into fantasy, which is going to cause, you know, it's gonna just keep escalating.
Well, there's room for all of it. That's what's cool.
Yeah, there's now room for it, and there's still, unfortunately, a strong adherence to some type of pre-existing work.
Right.
Which I think is a strength and a weakness.
Right.
It's a strength because obviously you know you have an audience. It's a weakness because my favorite way to explain this is Star Wars. First time you saw a lightsaber. First time you heard Luke. First time for Star Wars, the first time you saw everything was on the screen.
Right.
If I read a book, a Star Wars book, I hear Mark Hamill's voice.
Right.
You know what I mean? I hear James Earl Jones' voice whenever. So those characters, those actors are indelibly linked in my head and have become that experience. If I read a book before I watch the
movie,
you know, the movie or the television show or whatever, I have casted it in my I've cast it in my head.
Right.
I have the voice in my head. I have the look in my head. I have the body and the movement in my head. So anytime you go from a pre-existing work and you switch it to another medium, you're already dismissing it from a portion of your audience because they're all anybody who's already an adherent of that medium or of that experience is going to have what they saw in their head, and it's not going to be what you see on the screen.
Well, that's always why the books are always better than the movies. You know, it's like you're imagining.
Right, because you're doing so much more than they can possibly do on screen. Whereas if you see the screen version first, if the first time you're introduced to all that is when you see it with your eyes, you know what I mean? We've dismissed the strength of that.
Right.
You know, and it's upsetting to me. I'm like, and the thing is, the other thing that you could do, Fear the Walking Dead. Should have been the Walking Dead television show.
Right.
Don't try to tell that story. Maybe have a character from that story that vanished come into the story.
Right.
And finish telling their story. But you don't. The one-for-one adaptation, I think, is something we need to move away from.
I agree.
Because we're not doing it any justice.
Well, and it's also like you're kind of slowing down the creative process to have new ideas. Like,
right.
Like, how can the 80s have this huge renaissance of so many movies, characters, things that now we're just regurgitating instead of, like, innovating something new? So I'm right there with
people. People are afraid to take risks. Well, and not only that, but, like, when you do a translation, and every time I talk to a game designer, a comic book artist, or a comic book writer or anything, I'm like, make your story diverse.
Right.
Because when they go to the screen, they're going to start doing race changing, and it's going to piss off your fans. So put it in there when you write the, you know what I mean? When you initially do it, just do that. And then you don't have to worry about it.
Right. Right.
You know, because they start having, you know, they have to make a black Commissioner Gordon because there's very few black characters in Batman besides Lucius Fox.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean? So all of a sudden they're making a black Commissioner Gordon. When you start looking at a black Commissioner Gordon, you're going, okay, now a black Commissioner Gordon is a very, very different, a black Commissioner Gordon in Gotham is a very different animal.
Right. Yes.
Because a white guy who does not see the system and only sees the symptoms is one thing. A black guy who does the same thing is a completely different thing.
That's very true. It's interesting. You're tackling an issue that it's like, you're basically speaking things that like have been on my mind for a long time. Just because like you see, like the funny thing is art is an escape. Movies are an escape. Music is an escape. And it's like, it should show the reality of all the colors of the world, and it doesn't. Right. It's like it shows very select, you know, things that are everything's pigeonholed, you know.
Right.
There are always.
It's because everything, almost everything we consume, comes from the norm.
Right.
You know what I mean? We need to open up what is normal.
Well, let me ask you, how are you writing stuff that is changing that? Because I know you're writing stuff or producing stuff or kind of putting things together. How are you doing things to break a lot of those barriers?
It's just, it's actually easy. I just write what I know.
Right.
You know, but I write what I know in a way that is understandable to normal.
Which is what though? So, normal.
Normal is patriarchal. your old Judeo-Christian heterosexual. Right. That's right. Normal. So how do you make something that's different that normal can see? You know what I mean? And understand and resonate with. And that comes into, like you said, story and truth. You know, people respond to truth on screen regardless of what. Have you seen Sylvie's Love yet?
No.
You need to watch that film.
Sylvia's Love?
Sylvie's Love on Amazon Prime.
I'll watch it. I will watch it.
Tessa Thompson and Namadi. I can't remember the gentleman's name. But it's a black period film. And they don't make trauma. It's a non-trauma black period film.
Wow. That's awesome.
And the weird thing is, the entire movie,
You're waiting.
Yeah. I'm waiting for the event.
Right.
And it doesn't happen.
Oh, that's crazy.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful in how you're watching this thing, and it's this weird thing of, you know, you don't want to gloss over, and they mention everything, and there's instances of it, but it doesn't inform the narrative, the central narrative, which is these two people finding their way to love.
That's amazing.
In late 50s, early 60s, and they're black. And it's like, it was such a, like, weird feeling to watch that movie. It was such a refreshing feeling to watch that movie and see it and go.
Well, because all the tension was you. You were creating that tension.
I had the tension. There was no tension in the film.
Yeah, that's what's so crazy. It's like, you're waiting to do something.
I'm watching this love story, and I'm waiting for it to be a horror movie, and it's not. And they're like, look, there's no racial trauma in this film.
Right. Well, let me ask you, I'm going to ask you a very important question. I think this is for all actors, but really for African-American actors. So tell me what the audition process is like. Let's say the character is a white character, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're auditioning for it because you think the character in this does not have to be white.
Right.
Do you go to those auditions? Do you get those auditions? If you are in a situation where you get to audition in that, how is that experience? Tell me what that experience is like for you.
Well, here's the first of all, you don't get in the door unless they think the character doesn't have to be white.
Right.
So.
Well, you know what? Yeah. Yes and no, because I've heard of some characters have changed based on either the characters. You know, it doesn't even matter if it's a white character, a black character, a girl character, or boy, like it has shifted depending on.
Well, they do have it, but what I'm saying is, you get called in by the casting director,
right?
So the casting director and the producers at some point had a conversation and said, we are entertaining the notion of it not being a white guy,
right? So have you ever been in that situation where you've had to audition for something like that?
Yeah.
And tell me what that experience is like. Are you kind of like, you're walking into a room that's already kind of premeditated,
Well, no, because now that once that door has been opened, the thing about casting directors is casting directors want you to come in and blow them away.
Right.
A lot of performers forget that. They want you to come in there. They want you to be prepared. They want you to be excellent. They want you to be flexible. They want you to be delightful. They want you to light up their fucking screen, and they want you to be undeniable.
Right.
They want that of every single person that walks in that room.
Right.
They want you to be transcendent. They want to go, you know, well, there he is.
Right. Right.
They want you to make it impossible for them to not cast you.
Right.
They want that with their deepest desire. That's why they're calling you. And they're like, show me you. What do you have for this?
And so a lot of performers forget that. Yeah. So like when you're up against that, like, do you feel like, you know, because a lot of it is, you know, they may be doing these kind of like auditions as like a formality, you know, like they may already know.
Quite often.
You know what I mean? Which is bullshit. Mm-hmm. It's like, yo, don't make it a formality either. Like, be open to it and let me kind of change that perspective. Like, I know you've auditioned for stuff where you're like, this is bullshit. Because every actor I know has told me about these crazy auditions or how certain people got the roles because of who they knew, not because of what they could do. So, mm-hmm. like, let's say you walk into an audition and you know that this is not the part that they may think you're right for, but you have a connection to this character. You're feeling this character. How is it that you can kind of elevate or ascend past their preconceived notions of what the character is?
That's what happened with Goldface, actually.
Huh.
The way Goldface was written, it was written, he was described and written two different ways. He was described as a lot more of a identifiably urban character. Right. But he was written as more of a kingpin-y character. Hmm. You know what I mean? He was written as more of a boss. So there was some playroom there of, do you want to lean into the urbanization or do you want to lean into the bossification? And I leaned hard into the boss nature of
him. Right.
Like hard.
Why?
And I didn't want to play thug.
I like that. Well, it's also like you're like redefining what it is. You know what
I mean? I've played, you know, I've auditioned for the thug. I've literally turned down 7 thug auditions since quarantine started.
Wow.
Where I'm just like,
because you're tired of that fucking.
I'm working on I have a writing project I'm working on. I don't really want to be out in the time of COVID. Yeah, I mean, I'd rather just keep my butt home. So, you know, I am incredibly fortunate to have a gig. You know, I'm incredibly fortunate to not have any desire to play these roles.
Right.
You know, and so I just said, no, I'm not doing it. And they were like series regulars. You know, and this is the perfect time to come up because there's a lot of people who are not trying to leave the house.
Right.
You know, so there's a lot of people, especially established actors, that have, you know, more to lose. So this is a good time for new people or people who need a breakthrough, like I do, to have that thing. But I'm not going to break through. I am doing my best to avoid breaking through as a stereotypical character.
Right. I love that. I love that you're.
Yeah. I don't want to do it. I mean, I have stereotypical things on my roster. I have stereotypical things I'm you know attached to right now. I don't need to push any more of that. I've done that. You know, I've done that. I'm doing that. Let's do something new.
It's funny. It's like I've been, you know, I've been an artist for so long in music, and it's like I've always been. I did the foundation of learning so much music that somebody else wrote, whether it's Mozart or Brahms or, you know, any of these operas. And then it's like you get into pop music and soul music and funk and rock, and you learn all these different, you know, genres and styles and techniques. And then you realize, okay, I have two choices. I can either write my own stuff or write for somebody else, or, you know, perform as a backup for somebody else or perform my own stuff. And I kind of like was like, you know what, I'm just going to perform my own stuff. And so I did that for so long and kind of created that role that I wanted to establish myself. And then it came time to write for somebody else. And it was like, it was easy to still fight for the songs I believed in or, you know, to push that. And a lot of it came from just like what you're saying. It's like, you don't want to be anybody but yourself. And there's no greater role than you can play in any role than to put yourself in the role. You know what I mean? So I love
who are you in this situation?
Yes. And you know that it takes a lot of courage to turn down those roles that you're turning down right now so that
But I'm not but here's the thing. Like and on the one hand, I'm not turning down the role. I am not putting myself in that position because let's be honest. There's so many people, there's so many like you know, the audition process is incredibly complex. The casting process is incredibly complex.
Right.
It's incredibly complex and it's incredibly difficult. And I've literally auditioned, booked roles, like gone in for fittings, and then find out that one of the producers had already promised that role to somebody else and got shifted. God. Yeah. Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's bullshit.
Yeah. Well, but it is what it is. You know, there's a miscommunication. The person who was working on this end did not know what the person that worked on this end had done.
Yeah, but that's amateur hour to me, dude. It's like, how do you know?
It happens though, you know, or somebody gets fired and all of a sudden, you know what I mean? There's shifts, you know, there's so many different ways that you can end up not somewhere where you thought you were going to be.
Right.
Even you know the story of Ghostbusters?
I know Dan Aykroyd originally wrote it for the guy that died. Oh, I didn't know that. Seriously?
The Winston Zeddemore role was written for Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy decided to do 48 Hours instead.
What?
In the original script, Winston Zeddemore was an ex-Navy SEAL, and he was the only competent member of the group.
Wow.
He was a badass, and all the other three were bumbling idiots. Eddie went and did 48 Hours instead of that. Ernie Hudson auditioned for the Navy SEAL role.
That is crazy.
He didn't win it for that role. By the time they got to filming, he was a blue-collar worker. He didn't show up till a third of the way in the movie. And he was just a member of the team that just kind of, you know, helped out.
So who do you think made that change?
Well, when they realized they weren't getting Eddie Murphy, when they realized they weren't getting a major star, and the producers probably started putting pressure on these guys to not – I mean, who was – let's be honest. Who was Ernie Hudson at the time?
Right. Right.
So you got these three known entities in Dan Aykroyd, you know what I mean, Ivan Reitman – And so you have these three known entities, and then you have this unknown guy. You don't put him front and center. You let the other three shine.
The crazy thing is Dan Aykroyd wrote that for John Belushi.
Bill Murray role. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was just like, yo, John, I've got this great thing that I'm working on called Ghostbusters. You know, we're going to be taken care of because John Belushi had just done these shitty comedies that he was super bummed about. So, like, it's just weird to see how all of those things shift and how things fall into place. Man, I didn't know the Eddie Murphy factor. How did you find that out?
I read it. You know, if you look it up, you can see it.
That is wild, dude. I've never heard that.
But super quick, though, imagine a world where there was a super competent black guy who led a team of paranormal hunters.
Right.
In the 80s.
Right. Why do you think Eddie Murphy would have turned that down?
He did 48 Hours.
But I mean, do you think it was the content, or it was the payday?
I think he was trying to get away from the kiddie stuff and do more adult content, you know, because he was more of an adult content guy, Eddie was.
Right, right.
So that's, he was like, I want to do something a little more hard hitting.
Well, yeah. You know, it's interesting too, because it's like you see all the, you know, there's a great. Have you seen the Eddie Murphy, Jerry Seinfeld, Comedians with Coffee?
No, I need to watch it.
It's amazing because they talk about how they kind of came up together, and you know, like Eddie Murphy talks about how like Richard Pryor like always vibed him out. Bill Cosby vibed him out because he was like the new kid up and coming, and like they weren't cool with it because they were trying to hold on to their own kind of success on some level. So like they weren't really like welcoming, and he talks about all that, you know. So it's interesting to see like somebody. You know, Eddie Murphy is one of the most powerful African American actors, one of the most powerful actors. But it's like, you know, he did it in a way that he didn't have to do a lot of the roles that are now offered to African Americans. You know, it's like he kind of sidestepped, you know. So I love that you're taking that kind of stance to just create stuff. And what kind of characters, like, what is a character or what is a role that is like a dream role for you? I mean, besides, I know it's already the fantasy, but like outside of that, like what's a role you're like, man, I would love to play that role.
Like, you know, I mean, there's some like there's a character I have that's kind of like a black Indiana Jones.
Dope.
You know, that would be really fun and interesting to play. There's some, you know, a black pulp hero. You know, I have a black Superman movie show idea that's pretty dope. I got a lot of, you know, and some of these I'll play, some of these other people will play. I got a lot of stuff, dude. But it's all, you know, it's all hero characters.
So let me ask you this. Is there a discipline for you where you're writing a certain amount or thinking about like cultivating these certain ideas, or do you kind of like have like a game plan? You're like, I want to do this in acting first and then kind of like cultivate these ideas at the right time. Like, what's your?
I got a very, very busy life, so personal life. So I'm it's kind of at the mercy of my free time. Right. And now that I've taken this writing position, it's even harder because, you know, last thing I want to do after writing all day is write.
Right. That's true.
So, you know, so I have them all over my computer in various stages of completion and, you know, different computers and things like that. So it's kind of, you know, as interest. arises and people talk to me about them, or somebody says, "Ooh, I like that idea. I would like to develop that." You know, it's kind of a joint thing. You know, somebody's got to say, "Hey, I want to do something with that," or "I was looking for an idea like that with you. Let's do something," and then it'll come up.
Damien,
in the meantime, I'm still poking away at my own stuff. So
you have been a tremendous guest, and I definitely look forward to more things from you. What's next for you? What are the things that you want to see, you know, for your career in 2021, or just, you know, for the culture of film?
I want to see more truths outside of the
good answer.
outside of the norm.
Right.
We've seen the norm. I'm not saying go do away with the norm. The norm has still got stories to tell. But I'm more interested in seeing things that that approach it from a different angle.
Love it. Where can people find you if they want to cast you in something?
I'm at Damien Poitier everywhere. Twitter,
spell it out,
Facebook.
Spell it out because people are dumb.
Okay. @ is that right there? Is that in
yeah,
the,
yep,
in the
yep,
shot?
Yep, that's in the shot.
@DamionPoitier. That's @DamionPoitier.
Damien, you are a tremendous soul. I wish you the best. Mm-hmm. We are going to keep in contact. We may have to collaborate on some future stuff. And, dude, please. I wish you all the best. Stay healthy.
You too.
Stay
Thank safe. You.
Thank you for being you a too. Guest, man.
Thanks appreciate for having you, me, man. Much
yeah,
appreciated.
Man. All right. We'll have you on again, man. So keep awesome. Keep your phone close, okay?
Right. Will do. Right, will
bro.
Do. Thanks,
I'll
brother.
Talk to you soon, man.
Yep. Take care.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.